Welcome to the Feisty Women's Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Gross, Ironman champion, PhD in women's history, and founder and CEO of Feisty Media. I started this show because I wanted to cut through the BS of diet culture and fitness culture and actually learn from high-achieving women at the top of their game who have figured out how to feel and perform their best at every stage of life. So I chat with experts, elite athletes, and leaders who have learned to succeed despite the massive gender data gap in exercise and medical science and product development. Every episode is filled with information, advice, and anecdotes that will help you fulfill your potential as an athlete, mom, leader, or business owner. And listen up. If you don't subscribe to our Women's Performance newsletter, you are definitely missing out. It's totally free. So head over to womensperformance.com and subscribe now. That's womensperformance.com. This podcast is a production of Feisty Media. Hello, Feisty friends. Sarah Gross here. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode of the Women's Performance Podcast. For the next 4 weeks, you are in for a treat. I am extremely happy to present a four-part mini-series all about how our female hormones affect our performances in sport and life. The series is called Hormonal. And I love that name because who among us has not been talked down to and disregarded with the use of that word? Oh, just ignore Sarah. She's hormonal. Or you know how women get sometimes. They are so hormonal. At Feisty, we are all about reclaiming language, turning it on its head and saying, yeah, we are hormonal and it's amazing. And we are going to harness those hormones to get the best out of our bodies. The mini-series is hosted by two women who are truly subject experts. First, double board certified obstetrician and reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Carla DiGirolamo, who has been featured in Boston Magazine as one of Boston's best doctors every year since 2019. Carla is joined by Feisty's own Celine Yeager, who has been hosting the Hit Play, Not Pause podcast since 2020 and has conducted over 160 interviews with leading experts and top athletes in the perimenopause and menopause space. Combined with her background as a health and science journalist, Celine is great at reading the research and translating it into actionable steps for active women. During these four episodes, over the next 4 weeks, you will learn everything you need to know to work with your body and perform. Episode 1 covers all the basics about your hormones, whether you really need to sync your training routine with your menstrual cycle, how to know when and why you might need hormone testing, and what happens when your hormones start fluctuating in your 40s or flatten out in your 50s and beyond. In episode 2, Celine and Carla cover hormonal contraceptives. We all want to know about birth control, don't we? And how it affects our training. They cover pregnancy and fertility as they relate to our physical activity. And in episode 3, the two discuss common hormonal problems like PCOS and endometriosis. And if all of your questions are not answered after those three episodes, you can ask. So episode 4 answers listener questions about hormones. I've seen some of the questions that have already come in and they are so good. If you have a question and it's before the end of April 2024, just head to the show notes, click on the link and ask away. So for everyone who is sick of the narrative that women's hormones are a curse instead of a blessing, we are here for you. And together we will learn how amazing it actually is to be hormonal.
All right, my friend, we are back for round 3 of Hormonal.
Thank you for having me once again.
So let's talk, which I think is not talked about a whole lot, like hormonally related conditions that a lot of women are affected by. PCOS, there's a lot of things that come up in our communities. But I think I want to start with the word balance, because that is a word that is literally everywhere in the social media sphere and TikTok and everywhere. Everyone talks about balancing your hormones, balancing your hormones. And even when I go to medical sites, when I was doing some research for this episode, looking at these conditions, they call them conditions of hormone imbalance, right? So what does this mean? What does it mean to have balanced hormones?
So I'll be honest, I'm not a huge fan of the word, only because it gets conflated with the normal, sometimes dramatic changes, natural, normal hormonal changes that women go through. And when we, like, I think perimenopause is a good example where, yes, this is a very trying time of what you're experiencing, but it's not hormonal imbalance. This is what happens at this time of life. This is a normal occurrence. And if we start labeling it as an imbalance, or if menopause is an imbalance, now it's a disease when it's not. And so women throughout their reproductive lives are going through hormonal changes. Puberty is a huge one. Pregnancy is a huge one, and then perimenopause and menopause. And all of these phases are normal things. They're not imbalances. Now, they might feel like imbalances, but they're not hormonal imbalances. And what we need to do is just understand that, okay, this is physiology. Sometimes it's unpleasant. I mean, God knows childbirth wasn't exactly painless, right? Our hormonal changes are not always pleasant. And, you know, but what we have to do to be able to navigate them successfully is to really understand, okay, what is normal physiology and what is not normal physiology? And so, you know, the word balance has almost taken on a meaning kind of like bioidentical, right? So it's like a marketing thing, you know, that a lot of influencers out there say, okay, I'm a hormone balancing coach. And it's like, no, you're not, because that doesn't really exist. Just like bioidentical hormones, I'm going to, you know, make you this concoction that is fit to your lab values, when they might be synthetic versions of or derivatives of other hormones. So, you know, the true definition winds up getting warped and convoluted and conflated with things that that, you know, don't really, are not really bioidentical or are not really imbalances. So right. That's the first thing I wanted to put out there about this word balance. And so when we talk about this stuff, I'm going to make a clear distinction about what is something that's pathological or not normal versus something that is normal.
Okay.
So that, I just wanted to throw that out there, because that word balance does get conflated into a lot of things.
It really does. But just to put a really fine point on that, when we use hormone therapy for the fluctuations that happen during menopause that are, can be quite disruptive to a woman's well-being, let's say, we're not necessarily balancing. What are we doing?
You're treating the symptom.
Right. But like what hormonally are we doing? Are we flattening anything? Are we, I mean, cause we're putting hormones in the system, right? Like what is, if you don't call that balance, I guess, what do you call it?
It's simply treating a symptom. Okay. So to think about balance is to almost think about recreating the normal physiologic process, which is not what you do when you are treating symptoms. What you're doing is you're using a medication that is effective for treating a symptom. Because, you know, like say, if you're thinking about hormone therapy for menopausal symptoms, you're giving estrogen to affect the receptors so that you don't have hot flashes.
Right.
You're not recreating your physiological hormonal state that you had before menopause.
Right.
So that's why when we use hormones to treat these conditions, you're not balancing anything. You are treating a symptom within the normal milieu of the hormonal state you are in at the time.
I totally get that. I think, you know, a little light bulb went off as you were talking, that I think that the word balance probably comes to people's minds because we hear, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it's the fluctuation that is so disruptive and that makes us feel imbalanced, if you will. And then when you add like a hormone into there, we feel like more balanced because that fluctuation isn't affecting us as much. Does that make sense? Am I making sense there?
It does. And what we're balancing then is the effects of the hormones, not the hormones themselves.
Right.
Because you're treating the symptom. So what we're perceiving as balance, meaning, you know, what is our overall state of well-being? I think that's what we're referring to. But you're not balancing the hormones per se. You're treating the symptoms. But treating those symptoms may make you feel much more, quote unquote, balanced and in a much better state of well-being. It's splitting hairs and it's academic, but the reason I do it is because when we start calling normal physiological processes and imbalances, we now are making normal hormonal fluctuations out to be a disease state. And that's kind of why we got to menopause being a disease to begin with, is because of the use of this terminology without really clarifying what it is.
Completely, completely with you. I think that one more question I have there then is if I am on hormone therapy, I'm not, but say I am. And if before I was going to be on hormone therapy, you took my labs, you know, you took my hormone levels. And as we know, they can be all over the place, right? Depending on the time of day, depending all kinds of things. If you then give me hormone therapy, are those levels steady?
Levels are never steady.
Okay. I never asked that question. Okay.
Yeah, no, they're never steady. I mean, again, you're treating a symptom. We'll go back to hot flashes because that's a really simple one.
Yeah.
Your estrogen receptors are looking for something. They're looking for estrogen because they're not seeing as much of it because of those normal fluctuations of that stage of life. But when you use hormone therapy, now the receptors are seeing that hormone, and therefore the hot flashes are better managed. That doesn't mean that hormonal chaos isn't going on around you, because there's 100 other hormones involved in those changes. But you are treating a very specific thing with a very specific hormone. Estrogen is only one, as you know, of a gazillion hormones and secondary metabolites that are raging during that time of life. So that's why it really is just a specific treatment for a specific symptom. And really, although we feel more balanced, and that's fantastic, we want to feel balanced, the hormones aren't. The hormones are doing their thing that they're supposed to do during that phase of life, but we're managing it. We're managing the effects of those hormone fluctuations rather than balancing the hormones themselves.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you for entertaining that with me, because I actually had never thought about carrying that all the way through to that conclusion. So
I just don't want women to think there's something wrong with them when there isn't, because that just leads to a lot of problems. So that's why I went there. Yeah, no.
As we head into summer, rest and recovery are critical for improving sports performance, reducing stress, and living a long and healthy life. We should all invest in better sleep. So think about the thing you lay your head on for 8 hours a night. If it's not exactly right for you, it can lead to needless tossing and turning, or worse, have you waking up with an unrelenting kink in your neck. My new Lagoon pillow has helped me improve my sleep immensely by pairing me with the performance pillow that has everything I need. So I personally was matched with the Otter pillow. Shout out to Team Otter, which I love because it has a gentle cooling effect. And I was able to choose how much stuffing I wanted in it, which is super important to me because I'm doing a decent amount of CrossFit these days and my shoulders are kind of creaky. So having a pillow that is stuffed just to the right height keeps my neck and head in exactly the right position and comfortable for the entire night. And as of fall 2023, Lagoon launched their 100% mulberry silk pillowcases. It's cool to the touch, buttery soft, and great for your skin and hair. You've got to go check out this pillowcase if you want to feel great and look great every morning. Waking up for morning workouts has never felt better. I'm refreshed and pain-free thanks to my Lagoon pillow. To check it out for yourself, go to lagoonsleep.com/performance and take the 2-minute sleep quiz to find your perfect pillow match. And then use the code PERFORMANCE for 15% off your first purchase. That's code PERFORMANCE at lagoonsleep.com/performance, whole 15% off. And the link is in the show notes. You can just click through there. For decades, running shoes have been researched, tested, and designed for men. Brands have relied on the shrink it and pink it approach to sell male shoes to female customers. That's why we are so excited to be working with Hedas. Hedas designs athletic footwear for women that elevates performance, safety, and style. Hedas unlocks the science behind women's biomechanics through dedicated research, creates better shoes for women that support their longevity and performance, and establishes new design standards to promote transparency in a male-biased industry. Hedas have a lower ankle collar to reduce rubbing, a breathable mesh toe box to allow for ventilation and to allow for female toe shape, a special kind of plate in the midsole to keep tired legs going, a narrow heel cup to reduce heel slippage and take the pressure off our Achilles, and a rounded instep to create a snug fit. Hedas has 3 shoe models designed for different sessions: the Alma Cruise for long runs, the Alma Tempo for training days, and the Alma Speed for pushing the pace. I've personally been running in the Alma Cruise and I love them. It's the shoe I always wanted and never knew I needed. The fit is perfect in every way. You can get your own pair of Hedas at Hedas.com and use the code Feisty20 for 20% off. That's Feisty20 at Hedas.com and it will all be in the show notes.
So then let's talk about like what might be an actual imbalance, because are things like PCOS, is that an imbalance?
Yeah.
Polycystic ovarian syndrome? Okay.
It's a really good example of one. It's very simplistically when the ovaries and the adrenal glands are producing more male hormone than is supposed to be there. So you essentially have an imbalance of the ratio of male to female hormones because there's just too much male hormone there. And the effect of that imbalance is that it interferes with the normal communication, with the regular conversation that happens between the pituitary gland and the ovaries, that generates a normal menstrual cycle. So when you've got too much of another hormone, like testosterone and DHEAS and many of the other ones, when too much of that is around, it's like white noise. The messages can't effectively get from the pituitary to the ovary because you've got all this testosterone interference. So then the cycles become irregular or absent. So that is a perfect example of a hormone imbalance that exists. And I see a lot of PCOS as a fertility specialist. I see a ton of it.
What is the best course of action for it? I mean, my daughter has actually PCOS, and they put her on kind of a medium dose of metformin, and her cycles returned, which is interesting, right? So like what's happening there?
Yes. Metformin brings back ovulatory cycles in many women with PCOS. And I would have to dig into my metabolic pathways to tell you exactly why that happens. But there is some crossover in this crosstalk between the insulin, like the IGF-1 system, mm-hmm. and the reproductive hormone axis. And I think what the current belief is about that is that when you normalize some of what's going on in that insulin pathway, that can somehow dial down the interference with the male hormones and bring that natural menstrual conversation back. Now, it doesn't always work. It works in some people, but it doesn't always work. And sometimes when you use metformin with another medication like clomiphene citrate, that's a very common ovulation induction agent, the two work very well together synergistically and can be very effective if one is trying to get pregnant. But metformin can definitely bring cycles back, and it has something to do with the crosstalk between the insulin pathways and the reproductive pathways.
Well, and her blood sugar, because it does affect insulin resistance as well, the mm-hmm. PCOS. I mean, because like you're saying, there's that hole in, so all of those metrics improved, which Which makes me wonder, you know, because this is a performance podcast, how does something like a PCOS affect women? You know, I have several friends who bike race with it, and they say they've struggled with it, you know, because it can cause unwanted weight changes and all of that. So how does that affect performance?
Yeah, I mean, if people are having trouble controlling their weight, that is huge, you know, especially for a weight class athlete in particular.
Yeah.
I mean, and plus the irregular cycles, you know, when you have irregular periods, you're in the middle of a race, you don't want to worry about, oh my God, I got my period in the middle of mountain biking, you know. So the irregular periods can really be problematic for athletes who, you know, have events that, you know, that are scheduled and that they need to perform. But also the insulin resistance, the weight gain, and some of the overall health effects. But that can be an issue. Hair growth, you know, if you're a swimmer, you know, and you're constantly having to shave and laser and things like that, that can kind of get in your head if you're in a sport that requires you to not be wearing much clothing. So that's another way that people struggle with it.
What is the best course of action for treating it?
Well, the first thing is you got to make sure that's what you're dealing with. There are a lot of conditions out there that mimic it. One is non-classic congenital adrenal hyperplasia, something that we don't hear a lot about, but it looks just like PCOS. So you want to make sure that you know what you're dealing with. You want to check thyroid. You want to make sure that's functioning okay. You want to make sure that you're checking all of the downstream potential impacts of PCOS, like cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, things like that. So it also depends on what your goal is. So if you're a woman who is not worried about getting pregnant at the moment, then probably regulating cycles is the number one priority, or regulating bleeding. We won't call it regulating the cycles, but regulating bleeding is something that people usually prioritize if pregnancy is not in the picture at the moment. Birth control pills, very effective for doing that. And IUD, also very effective for doing that. Now, you're not treating the PCOS per se, you're treating the symptoms.
I was just going to say, is that taking care of the underlying imbalance, you know, that we started talking about here?
Well, here's the thing. We don't really know how to take care of the underlying imbalance, because PCOS is a funny disease. You see it, you see different subtypes of it. The vast majority, I'd probably say at least 60% of the PCOS that I see are in women with obesity. And so the big question is the PCOS cause the obesity, or did the obesity cause the PCOS? We don't really know. But what we do know is that managing carbohydrate intake, not necessarily decreasing it, but managing the insulin spikes that one can be very sensitive to. That's where metformin comes in, is to, you know, helping to manage the insulin spikes. You want to make sure your glucose is managed well, because that's a struggle with people with PCOS. And also, if you carry that diagnosis, especially if obesity is in the picture, you have a higher risk later on in life of developing high blood pressure, hypercholesterolemia, and diabetes. That's called the metabolic syndrome. And so people with PCOS, especially the obesity subtype, are at higher risk of developing that. So you want to, you know, make sure that your exercise, your nutrition plan is reflective and mindful of the potential risk of developing those things. So there's a lot of lifestyle stuff there. And a lot of times, if one is obese and has this, just losing 5% of body weight can bring cycles back.
Yeah.
So weight loss can be a very effective management strategy if you have obese PCOS. Now, you could be like the other 15% that have lean PCOS, and that is thin women who have this overproduction of male hormones. That's a little bit trickier, because that's not an obesity related thing. So, you know, they may be people who have a healthy diet, who train, but they have this physiology. And a lot of times there is not much we can do about the underlying cause, because there's a lot of debate about what the underlying cause is, and there's no real consensus on it.
All right. Work with your doctor and manage your, I mean, it's multifactorial. So I'm hearing just managing all of these, downstream effects too can help.
Yeah, you want to manage the symptoms that you care about. You know, if it's control, you know, if it's managing bleeding events, you want to use hormonal therapies like a Mirena IUD or birth control pills. If fertility is your goal, then we have lots of ovulation induction agents. It's very effectively treated. You know, women who are young with PCOS get pregnant all the time. It's fairly easy to treat. So it really depends on what your goal is at the moment and, you know, in what's your priority. But for everybody, no matter what your goal is, you want to make sure that you manage those risks downstream of high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and diabetes.
Excellent. What other conditions are coming? That's the top one that came to my mind. You know, I don't know. You are obviously a reproductive endocrinologist. Like, what are the top causes of infertility?
I'd say PCOS is probably right at the top. Because it affects ovulatory cycles, there is a direct relationship between the hormone imbalance and fertility, because that's the primary impact is on the menstrual cycles. Now, that being said, I'm sure there are many educated people in the audience that will say, well, you can have PCOS and still have regular menstrual cycles. That is true. You can, but sometimes that hormone imbalance doesn't create a favorable environment in the endometrial lining for implantation. So even when the menstrual cycles are quote unquote normal, sometimes the hormonal environment still isn't optimal for implantation. So PCOS takes on many different faces, but that is a direct result. The infertility is a direct result. Now, other things like hyperprolactinemia, that also can have a direct effect on fertility because that also can disrupt the menstrual cycles. Prolactin is a hormone secreted by the pituitary gland. We don't pay much attention to it in regular everyday life, but it is very important during breastfeeding. It has to do with milk production. And so when we're breastfeeding, our prolactin levels remain high, so that milk production remains high. And when prolactin levels fall, then milk production tends to dry up. Or prolactin levels usually fall after breastfeeding starts to wean and then, you know, and stops. And it's interesting what Mother Nature has programmed into us. When prolactin levels are high, periods usually are lost because nature doesn't want you getting pregnant again, right, while you're still feeding other offspring. So that's kind of nature's intention there. Even though it's not perfect, people get pregnant while they're breastfeeding all the time. But that's another thing. Now, when you're not pregnant or breastfeeding, we still can have high prolactin levels because the pituitary gland can be either overactive, just cranking out prolactin for no apparent reason, or there can be a small growth in the pituitary gland called a microadenoma. Macroadenomas also can cause this as well. But the microadenoma is the most common cause of hyperprolactinemia that's caused by a lesion. And it's just a little growth that's cranking out prolactin. And so we have medication that can treat that. And what it does is it's a dopamine, I want to say, antagonist. And it affects the dopamine pathway so that it drives those prolactin levels down. And so when that happens, the periods typically come back. People get pregnant, no problem. Sometimes it resolves, sometimes it doesn't on its own. So that's another hormonal imbalance that has a direct impact on fertility. Thyroid, hypo or hyperthyroidism is another hormonal imbalance. Usually it doesn't, unless it's dramatic, unless it's really, really severe, we don't usually see it having a direct impact on conception, but it is incredibly important for after conception happens because the baby needs thyroid to develop properly. And if the fetus isn't getting enough thyroid hormone, there can be cognitive deficits and mental retardation and things like that. So we're very vigilant about making sure we identify hypothyroidism, which is low thyroid, so that we can treat it before pregnancy is established so that we can make sure the fetus has what it needs. So PCOS, hyperprolactinemia, hypo and hyperthyroidism are probably three of the most common things I see on a day-to-day basis with as a fertility doctor.
Would the latter of those two impact a woman in any other way as well? Like when we're talking about performance, would it show up in some way? It occurs to me thyroid probably would.
Thyroid, yeah, because of the fatigue. The thyroid gland is such an important gland. It runs just about everything in the body. It affects everything. Like sometimes people with hypothyroidism can have major depressive disorders. So there can be some significant mood issues with people with hypothyroidism. And sometimes in rare cases, that's the only thing they present with. So if someone, one of the things I remember learning in medical school was that if someone presents to you with depression, always get a thyroid because that may be the only symptom manifesting it. That's unusual, but it's something as a physician you don't ever want to miss. So mood disturbance, which certainly can affect performance, fatigue, that's a big thing. And the other thing that is related to thyroid and performance is when we start talking about energy imbalance, LEA, low energy availability, because when people are in LEA for an extended period of time, and when it's severe and when it becomes red S, the thyroid is dialing everything down to conserve energy. So you can have thyroid, quote unquote, dysfunction simply because it's trying to adapt to this chronic energy inavailability. So thyroid, I think, is hugely important in performance because of the impact of energy availability issues, which is we know is huge in the female athlete community. But also, primary thyroid disorders like hypo or hyperthyroidism can affect fatigue and energy expenditure. It can affect weight, et cetera.
Yeah, we've done a whole show on Hashimoto's, which is
Most common cause of hypothyroidism. Yep.
yeah, and that's, I'll link that to the show. That's a whole other ball of wax. But why are women more, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like women are more susceptible to thyroid disorders. Is that true?
It is. I forget what the statistics are, but especially as midlife comes along, you see an increase in the incidence of hypothyroidism after 35. And it also could be hormonally involved too, because we see a lot of this in the postmenopausal population. It's uncertain whether it's menopause related or whether it's age related, but it definitely increases in frequency as we get older, and it definitely is more common in women than in men. I forget by what multiple, but it definitely is without a doubt pretty well accepted that it is.
And what should we do? I mean, should we just get our thyroid tested as a matter of course?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, when you look at the recommendations for how often one should get their thyroid checked, it's surprising to me how infrequent the intervals are. It's something like every 5 years or so after 35. And it's like, geez, for something that is so common in women and can have such an impact, it seems like we should be checking it more often than that. It's kind of like the bone density scan that you get at 65, right?
Yeah.
When the horse is already out of the barn. When I have patients coming to see me for fertility, and granted, when you're getting pregnant is a whole other different issue. I'm checking thyroid every year. Do I think that non-conceiving women should get their thyroid checked every year? Probably not. But especially if you have a family history, if mom had thyroid disease, if your sister has thyroid disease, if both of them have Hashimoto's, maybe you check it a little more frequently, like maybe every 3 years or every 2 years. What's the harm? God knows we check hormones for every other reason that that we shouldn't be. Let's just check something that has some utility.
Yeah, and if you're checking, I'm thinking for your standard panel where you're checking lipids and everything else, I mean, you might as well just.
Throw the TSH in there. Doesn't hurt. Yeah.
As a lifelong runner and triathlete turned CrossFitter, I am stoked to announce that the athletic eyewear brand Tafosi Optics has joined us as a partner here at Feisty Media. Tafosi sports glasses hit all the marks for athletes. They're shatterproof polybicarbonate, so the lenses not only reduce glare, but also offer scratch resistance, which I 100% need. They stay in place when you are moving. The hydrophilic rubber nose pads actually get more grippy the more you sweat, so they are secure and don't slide down your face even when you're running in hot conditions. No matter what sport you do, Tafosi has shades for you. Whether you love tennis, fishing, pickleball, running, cycling, or just hanging out on the beach. They are super reasonably priced, which I love, so I can have multiple pairs that go with any outfit. And of course, Feisty listeners get a special discount. So, head on over to tofosioptics.com and use the code FM20. FM as in Feisty Media to get 20% off your order. That's FM20 at tofosioptics.com. I'll put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you. Endurance sports should be accessible to everyone, right? That's why we are so excited to be partnering with Motive. Motive is one of the fastest growing training apps in the world today, with thousands of amateur athletes signing up every month and a nearly perfect 4.9 star rating in the App Store. You are not a template and your training plan should not be either. Prepare for running races, triathlons, cycling events, duathlons, or swim runs, however your season schedule shapes up, and get training written by some of the best coaches in the world in each discipline who know what it takes to help amateur athletes reach their goal on race day. The app takes the training written by those experts and then creates the most optimal training plan for your schedule, abilities, and goals. Plus, the training is fully customized to your race schedule. How much you can train each week, your current abilities, and the goals you want to achieve in your race. You can use the app for free as long as you want, or get all the upgraded features from the app for just $19.99 a month. But as a Feisty listener, you can sign up at mymotive.com and use the code FEISTY for 2 months of full premium access. That's right, you get 2 months of premium for free. So you quite literally have nothing to lose. So head over to mymotive.com, mymotive.com, and use the code FEISTY, FEISTY. And on a personal note, I know the founder of Motive, and he is driven to make triathlon and all endurance sports more accessible for the athletes who care about their performance, but who aren't quite ready for a full-time personal coach. If that sounds like you, definitely try the app for 2 months for free. You literally have nothing to lose. Building muscle can be tough, and gains can be so slow, even for those of us who do a lot of strength training. As an ex-endurance athlete who is now in perimenopause, I know this all too well. It can be frustrating to put in the time in the gym and not see the results I'm looking for. That's why it's super important to take the right supplements at the right time. One of those supplements is essential amino acids, which are needed to trigger muscle protein synthesis. Muscle protein synthesis happens when you eat high quality protein, like eggs or whey. And by supplementing with additional essential amino acids, you can make sure you are getting the full benefit of your training sessions. Targeted essential amino acid formulas can be up to 4 times more effective than just eating protein. I've been taking amino acids for almost a year, and in combination with eating quality protein and a couple other supplements, I have managed to turn the tides on age-related muscle loss, which starts at 30 for women, by the way, and I have continued to make strength gains as I head towards 50. AminoCo has been a longtime sponsor of Feisty Media and has supported all of our brands and podcasts over the years. I recommend starting with AminoCo Perform, and you can grab some at aminoco.com/performance. If you enter the code PERFORMANCE, you will save 30% and receive a free gift if it is your first purchase. Give it a try and let me know how it goes. That's aminoco.com/performance and use the code PERFORMANCE to save 30%.
So I had originally thought of including endometriosis, but it's not really an imbalance. I still want to talk about it, but endometriosis seems like a mystery to me. Like, how does that tissue get outside of where it's supposed to be? Like, talk a little bit about that condition.
It is a mystery even still in the gynecology world among all of the experts. There are various theories as to How does that, well, let's define it
So
first
yeah,
for
let's
those.
talk.
Yeah,
Let's define it.
let's define it first.
The
So
uterine
what is
tissue is
end?
not where it's supposed to be.
That's basically it. It winds up in very strange places. So the uterine lining cells belong inside the uterus, and the lining cells are where the baby will implant. It's like that nice down quilt that goes on your bed. It's nice and soft. That's where the embryo implants. So what happens is, with endometriosis, the feathers of that quilt goes all over the house. And it's making people sneeze, it's creating all kinds of inflammation and aggravation. And this is what happens when you have endometrial cells that wind up in the abdominal cavity. It wreaks havoc because they're not supposed to be there. And so what happens is there's this massive inflammatory response of the tissues to something that doesn't belong there. It's like having that splinter in your finger that hurts and turns red, and it's just not supposed to be there. But that's what's happening in the pelvis when you have these cells where they're not supposed to be. And it's not just limited to the pelvis. You can have endometrial cells on your bladder, on your intestines, in your lungs. You can have it in the brain. I mean, it's can it go into the brain? All right, I'll retract that. I'm not 100% sure it can go in the brain, but it definitely goes to the lungs and to lots of other parts of the body. We see it in scars, like in surgical scars. We'll sometimes see it. It's like a big menace in gynecology. And so why does it happen? I mean, you just raised that point. We don't know why. There are lots of theories. I think the retrograde menstruation theory is probably the one that's the most widely accepted. It's when your uterus contracts. You have those cramps when you have your period, where the uterus is pushing endometrial lining cells out the vagina. Well, we forget that the fallopian tubes are also an open passageway. So if the uterus is squeezing, it's like when you squeeze the toothpaste, right? If it's open on the front and the back, if you squeeze it in the middle, stuff's going to come out the back and the front. So what happens is, when the uterus contracts, you got endometrial lining cells that could go out the fallopian tubes and out the vagina. And so if it goes out the fallopian tubes, that is how the cells can wind up in the abdominal cavity. Now, the other component of that is an immune-mediated component. There is some theory out there that maybe there is something faulty in the immune system of people with endometriosis that can't gobble up those cells that wind up where they're not supposed to be. And so if the immune system can't manage them and they're hanging out there too long, it can create that inflammation. Again, just a theory. There's also another theory out there. It's called metaplasia, that actual cells that were, say, peritoneal cells, which is the lining of the abdominal cavity, that these cells somehow are triggered to morph into endometrial lining cells, and then again they're there and they're not supposed to be. I think people don't really pay much mind to that theory anymore. I think it's more retrograde menstruation and immune-mediated types of things. There's also a theory about adhesion molecules that, think of adhesion molecules as like little suction cups on the bottom of a cell, where if the suction cups are too grippy, then something's going to stick there where it's not supposed to be. So the thought is that, okay, if these cells wind up somewhere where they're not supposed to be, if their adhesion molecules are too robust, they're going to just stay there like glue. And so that could be, some sort of gene defect or whatever. So there's lots of different theories as to why and how endometrial cells get to where they go and why they wreak such havoc.
And you do not have to retract your brain thing. I just looked it up while you were speaking, and there is cerebral endometriosis.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. So something in my subconscious remembered
Yeah,
that from
there's a
somewhere. Yeah.
2022 study actually is just talking about it, and it may play a role in influencing progression of psychiatric conditions among individuals that have the disease.
Ooh,
So
yeah.
there you have it. I will put
Yeah.
that in show notes too. What do you do for it?
It's a nuisance. It depends on the issue. So typically, the way someone discovers that they have endometriosis is through pelvic pain. If their periods are exceptionally painful, to the point where they're debilitated, they can't go to work, they can't function. They'll seek care for that. And then sometimes they'll have an ultrasound done. And then sometimes, if the endometriosis is severe, you might see some cysts on the ovary by ultrasound that look like endometriosis, and then sometimes people will then do a surgery, and that's the definitive diagnosis. You can't diagnose endometriosis definitively without a surgery. But you can suspect it. You can see things on ultrasound that are suspicious, like the ovarian cysts that can go along with it. So if pain is your main issue, surgery can be a very effective treatment for that. It buys you some time, but unfortunately, because what feeds endometriosis is cycling estrogen, if you are a reproductive age woman, you can pretty much bet that that endometriosis is going to recur. Now, one of the things that suppresses endometriosis is birth control pills and progesterone. So, a lot of women will go on either combination birth control pills, and it's incredibly effective for suppressing endometriosis, or they might go on a progesterone-only type of contraception, like the Norplant was one. I think there's some other ones out there, but something that produces, constant progesterone is also very effective for minimizing that. And this is important for women, for performance, because pelvic pain can be a big deal, and that's going to impact performance. So managing those symptoms is important. So that's typically how it's managed, through surgery and through contraception. Sometimes, if endometriosis is isolated, like to around, like uterine pain, a progesterone IUD can also be very effective for period cramping, if that's like the only thing people have going on. So yeah, hormones are the treatment. And again, you're not treating the root cause of it, you're managing the impact of it, because with surgery you try to remove the implants, but like I said, if you have cycling estrogen, they're always going to come back. Pregnancy actually is the best treatment for endometriosis because of the progesterone of pregnancy for 9 months. And that can buy a woman a lot of time, even after she has her baby, of having pain, being free from pain from that condition after pregnancy.
Will it often go into remission post-menopause then?
Yeah, typically you won't see it. Once menopause hits,
Yeah.
your endometriosis should shrivel up, because what fuels it is estrogen, and that's what diminishes
Yeah.
after menopause.
Interesting. Really interesting.
Yeah.
So, we were going to talk about freezing eggs in the fertility episode, and we ran out of time. So I wanted to make sure that we actually circle back and cover that in this episode. What should women, it's becoming a more common practice as women are sort of delaying, their family planning. What should women know about egg freezing?
So I could tell you, I do a ton of it at Boston IVF, and it really escalated after COVID, because women, especially who are over 35, are like, I don't know what the dating scene's going to look like. I don't know if I'm going to find a partner. I better freeze my eggs, because who knows when
I'm not
things are going
supposed to
to
get
open up
close to
again.
anyone. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to stay 6 feet apart. So how's this ever going to happen? So in 2020, we really saw an uptick in that, and we're still seeing it. I think it gained some exposure, and people like that insurance policy. So first of all, egg freezing. Well, why do people do it? People do it to preserve their fertility options for the future. And that's really a very helpful thing, because if you're 35, 6, 7, and you're just getting into a relationship, you're very aware of your biological clock and your timeline. But on the second date, you really don't want to be talking about, okay, do you want to have kids? You hate to have that pressure on your relationship. But if you have eggs in the freezer, the great thing is those eggs are frozen in time. As you're chronologically aging, the eggs are not. So if you come back at 42 and you're finally ready to have a baby, and you're using your 32-year-old eggs, your chances of pregnancy are that of a 32-year-old, because those eggs are usually what drives your success rates, and they were frozen in time at 32, for example. So it's an incredibly great option for women who want to preserve their fertility. It is, you, if you're going to do it, you want to go to a place that does a lot of it, because the technique for freezing eggs is very, very, I don't want to say labor intensive, but it's very skill intensive. And so you want to make sure that the facility has embryologists that do this all the time, because eggs are incredibly fragile. And so a place like ours, Boston IVF, we do a ton of it. Some of the major academic centers will do it, because they will also preserve fertility for cancer patients. Oftentimes they'll freeze their eggs ahead of treatment. You want to go to a place that does a whole lot of it. So that's probably the biggest thing to know. Cost, everybody thinks it costs $50,000 to do an egg freeze cycle. It's really not that much. I mean, it's a chunk of change. It's about $12,000 to $15,000 at our facility all in. And you don't want to wait till you're 38, 39 to do it. If you're going to freeze your eggs, the best time to freeze your eggs is when you're under the age of 35. 35 to 37, still a good time to freeze your eggs. We would do some testing. We might need more eggs to get you the best chance of a live birth, but still reasonable to do. But for women who are in that age group, 38 to 40, who didn't expect to get a divorce and now will find themselves divorced because their partners decide they don't want kids or whatever. Be evaluated because it's still an option. Having some eggs is certainly better than not having any. When you're up against the clock, you're up against the clock, but if your egg reserve is good, it's still a viable option. Those are probably the main takeaways about egg freezing.
What do you actually do? Like, if I came in, like, what is the actual procedure?
It's fairly easy. I mean, first you have to do some testing because we have to get a sense of, what is your egg reserve like? Are you going to respond to the medication? We like to give people some sort of expectation, and we have to determine if they're a good candidate. If they're a good candidate, what we do is we usually do a prep month
How do
to
you
make sure.
check?
How do we check? A blood test on the third day of your period. It's a whole
Oh,
panel of hormones that we do.
okay.
We do FSH, estradiol, LH, AMH. Those are the typical ones that we do. And that gives us a sense. We can't like count eggs. We can't do that. But the hormones are reflective of what the underlying egg reserve is. And so that's the first thing we do is we check that. And then if we say that, okay, you're a good candidate, we usually have a prep month, which could be either 2 or 3 weeks of birth control pills, or if someone's ovarian reserve is a little sluggish, we would do like a priming month where at the end of a cycle, like 10 days, 7 to 10 days after ovulation, we're adding some estrogen patches and some injections. And that kind of gets the ovaries ready to be stimulated. And then for the treatment month, you're on about 10 to 14 days worth of injectable hormones. And these are hormones that are very close to your natural hormones. It's FSH with sometimes a combination of an LH type of hormone. We use HCG because it looks just like LH to the receptors. And you're on that for about 10 to 14 days. We have you come in for blood, ultrasound. We make sure that the eggs are developing properly. And then when we see that they're ready, we have you do your egg retrieval. And the egg retrieval is a 15-minute procedure done under sedation. It's done vaginally. So there's a vaginal ultrasound that we place, and then we can see the ovaries and where the eggs are. And then there's a long needle that we pass through the vaginal wall into the ovary. And that's how we harvest the eggs. There's no incisions. Takes about 10 or 15 minutes to do. Recovery is pretty much same day. Most people go back to work the next day.
Well,
And then you have eggs.
very cool. And how they last, how long in the freezer?
Years,
Yeah.
years, years. Yeah, years.
Can you
Like
paint them
five,
for Easter?
ten.
No, I'm just
We
kidding.
can't color them either.
No, can't make them unicorn eggs. That's fine. That's fine.
I mean, you can keep them 5, 10 years.
Okay.
No, it's a great option. It's a really great option. Now, if one has a partner that they know they're going to build a family with, it's always better to freeze embryos if that's an option for you. So if you're married, or if you have a partner that you know you're going to build your family with and you want to preserve your fertility for the future, banking embryos is a better way to go because the live birth rate per embryo is higher than like the live birth rate per egg. And it just has to do with how fragile eggs are and when they come out of the thaw, fertilization rates, things like that. Embryos are better if you have a partner that you're sure about. But for single women or for people who are in relationships and they don't quite know, what the end point is, freezing eggs is an awesome option as well.
It's very hard for me to listen to you say that and not go, doesn't it depend where you live?
Yes, it absolutely does depend on where you live. It really does. In terms of freezing embryos, right now, you always have to be careful. When you have states like Alabama who are passing laws like they recently passed, I mean, they walked it back and there was additional legislation to protect IVF centers from being prosecuted. That's the environment, and you really have to know what the laws are in your state. And go to a government site that tells you objectively what the laws are. Don't go on social media because there's a lot of fear mongering out there. You want to get your facts. So you want to know what is your state's policies regarding embryos and things like that. That's the only state I know of that has tried to put forth that type of legislation. So the abortion laws in most states, almost all states except Alabama, don't apply to IVF centers, but it's always something that you want to keep your finger on the pulse of because it could change.
And then is there anything in any of that procedure that would be, I mean, is it the same when we talked about fertility? You were talking about like the ovaries getting big and torsions and not doing things. When you're preparing to freeze your eggs, are there any of those same concerns or no?
When you're going through a stimulation cycle, yes, the concerns are exactly the same. So, when you're going through that 10 to 14 day worth of stim, you want to, you don't want to run, jump, or turn upside down. That's what I usually tell my patients. But, that during the stim and about a week after the retrieval, you want to let the ovaries heal, and then you can ease back into your regular routine.
Excellent. Is there anything that you thought about when we're talking about any conditions of hormonal imbalance or things along that line that we have not talked about in this episode?
I think we've talked about the most common ones. There's always your zebras and your unicorns out there, like Cushing's disease and things like that that I don't see much of as a reproductive endocrinologist. But they're very uncommon conditions out there. The ones we talked about are certainly not an exhaustive list of every hormonal imbalance you can have, but
Right.
they are the most common ones that that women should be aware of because they could have one of these and should be checked. Those are the most common. I think we covered the bases there. But just know that there are others out there, and you may be, one of those people that falls in the category of having an uncommon one. And so, a specialist would absolutely be able to help you sift through that.
So that wraps up episode 3. I want to remind people that we will be doing a Q&A episode to wrap up this series. So we have the speakpipe.com/hormonal. That link is in the show notes. If you have questions, you can leave us a voicemail. You can drop us a line at your friends at Feisty, livefeisty.com. And we look forward to doing the wrap-up Q&A of this next time.